Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today my guest is Jessica Shattuck. She's the author of a first novel, The Hazards of Good Breeding. It's published by Norton, and it's set in Concord, Massachusetts, and concerns largely the doings of the Dunlap family, who have been in the house they've been in for 274 years, barring a two-year stint during which they were occupied by Scandinavians, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, a little more than 2 years.
Now, small stint. Can you situate for me, I guess in literary terms, the kind of family this is? Is this a Henry James kind of family in previous years?
Yes, it's not a very intellectual family, though. It's very old Boston Yankee family, the earliest members of which came over on the Mayflower, and it has the property that they live in is one that the patriarch thinks of very fondly because he remembers, or he tries to remember back to his ancestors' days of fighting Indians off of it, and it's a real old, somewhat history obsessed family.
And the attitude of the narrator, who is none of the characters, is rather jaded toward these figures. They are seen as people who await their receding hairlines and their problems with masculinity. It's a kind of jaundiced and soured view. We're not beginning this book in a world in which these people are going to have time to prove themselves awful. They begin there.
Yeah, I think of it almost as that they begin there, and hopefully by the end of the book, they've become a little less awful. I mean, the book is told from five different perspectives, so I guess I have trouble isolating exactly what the narrator is and what that attitude is, because I really tried to get inside the head of each of the characters that I was writing from.
Now, Jane Austen seems to be in the background here, lurking, a kind of novel of judgment and marriage, in a sense. How does one proceed at a certain point in life? The point of life being, at least for the first character in the book, Carolyn, after college, deciding not to go to work at the Pacific Film Archive, going home to Concord, to that house. Those problems, a broken marriage between her parents, and she has herself just broken up with a boyfriend, so that she is really back, as many people are, on the first steps away from school all over again. She has nothing really planned in the way of a career. She's sort of shuttled things.
Yeah, it's sort of, I mean, I chose to start with her there because I think that the whole at least American school experience and college experience is kind of like it's almost like a playground. And then you get out of it and there you are in the real world, whatever that means. And she's sort of a typical American college graduate in that way, that it's June 7th or whatever, the day after graduation. And she's kind of realizing she's got to, now things really begin. And where's that?
Now, it's an interesting thing, because more than in most novels I can think of, a good deal has happened off stage. The marriage has broken up. The mother has had a nervous breakdown. Her relationship with her boyfriend has broken up. There are two brothers who never make an appearance in the novel, but who seem to be the Boston equivalent of frat tricksters, with pranks involving goats and lines of tied together shirts. Why so much off stage?
Well, the book is set over a really short period of time, as you obviously know. It takes place over 6 days, I think it is. And I really thought of it as the story is really something, it's kind of leading up to this explosive moment, as opposed to starting with a lot of chronicling of things that are beginning to go this way or that way. And because of the short time period, I just jumped right in. And I think that's also just the way I like to write. I find that in short stories, I tend to do that too. I want to start right in the middle of a moment that's kind of in the middle of a lot of stuff happening.
Now, the book centers, or at least is symmetrical, in that it begins with a school play, a musical version of Paul Revere's Ride, and ends with a version of Paul Revere's Ride as well. The cry is that the British are coming, but it's a kind of different cry in the actual circumstance, and I wondered if you could talk about that.
Yeah, you mean how that's an interesting question, how the British, what the metaphor is of the British are coming?
Yes.
Well, I was thinking about, there's a part in the book where I talk about Elliot, the little boy who is in the play, looking at the paintings of his classmates. They were doing a whole Paul Revere section of the class. So they'd also done related, you know, finger paintings and whatnot. And one of them above his head there's a little cartoon bubble coming from the Paul Revere's mouth, and it says, "Foreigners, get out," misspelled. And to me, I think that kind of gets at the heart of it, that I was thinking of it as there's this small insular world feels very threatened. The world that I'm writing about in you know, the kind of old Boston Yankee world feels in some ways very threatened by the larger world of mainstream America today, partly because it's sort of usurped its place. There was a time when the WASP world of, you know, white picket fences and old names and old families was really at the heart of the American dream narrative. And now I think that time is really over. And the successful immigrant story and J-Lo and Bill Clinton, he's not a successful immigrant story, but the sort of pull yourself up by your own bootstrap story is quintessentially American. It's really located elsewhere. It's not in this world of old families. And I think that I was kind of thinking about how the members of this small world deal with a larger world and how they feel it pressing upon them. And in Elliot's case, he's actually welcoming that encroachment. He wants his world to be exploded open. But I think he's sort of inspired by this idea of riding through the night and calling out for help, calling out.
Elliot is the youngest of four children, and he is the one who most wants the outside world, the world outside of Boston Brahmin old families, to come in, largely because his old family isn't there. He's alone in an old house most of the time, certainly during the summers when he's not at school. His father is at work, his mother is away, and he won't see her until she's come to sufficient stability mentally to be able to take custody of him for brief periods of time. And so he's been, in a sense, alone, except for his relationship recently ended with his nursemaid. Is it Rosita?
Yeah, his Colombian babysitter / housekeeper. Yeah.
And he develops kind of a crush on her, in a sense.
Yeah. She's sort of the one, I mean, I thought of it as, he's this pretty lonely little boy rattling around this big sort of crusty old house by himself with this very unaffectionate father. And Rosita, his babysitter, is kind of the spark of life in that very old setting, that very old, very cold setting. And she's much more alive to him than the, you know, ancestors that stare out of the portraits on the walls. And and I think that her way of being is very exciting to him. So it's something that he misses now that she's gone, which has happened also, one of the many things that has happened when the book begins. She's already out of the picture.
I'm speaking with Jessica Shattuck about her first novel, The Hazards of Good Breeding. Now, they say that first novels should be about one's experience. Is this the world that you come from?
You know, everyone always assumes that a first novel is autobiographical. It's really not. I mean, it's a world that I'm very comfortable with and have spent a lot of time in, but it's not a world that I think of myself as coming from. My father came from this world And his parents, who I spent a lot of time with growing up, were very firmly located in the world of country clubs and tennis playing and sort of Calvinist morals. But my father worked at the ACLU when I was growing up, and my mother was a German immigrant. And I think actually thinking about her experience coming into my father's family is something that in some way, you know, this is something I only recently thought of. I sit down and start writing this novel with this in mind, but I think that it was something that sort of subliminally I was thinking about when I started writing this. So, and Harvard, where I went to college, is very proximate to this world and perhaps maybe located actually firmly in its center. So I feel like I've spent a lot of time in it, and I think of it as a world that I can really pass in. to put it that way.
Well, a filmmaker arrives who is in many ways a foil for the novelist. The filmmaker has a set attitude toward not exactly what he expects to find, but what he hopes to find and is in fact looking for. A racist, insular, small-thinking society of people who cannot tolerate very much change. And he, you know, gets information from locals and manages to discover that the Dunlaps are on the cusp of some kind of family explosion. The divorce has been enough of an indication. And so he's watching, and the novelist, Jessica Shattuck, is in a sense watching him, saying that his kind of eye is insufficient to report these changes. It's an insufficiently, what, compassionate eye?
Well, that's maybe a part of it. I think something I was thinking about was that he's somebody who's come into the scene with a very, his whole theory of making a movie is that you have to have a very distinct picture, and you keep it clear, you keep it simple, and you come away with a good, succinct story you're telling. You're not going to overcomplicate, you're not going to look at the ambiguities. And I think that as a writer looking at this world, I was grappling with how to represent it, but how, for me, it was very important to include ambiguities and include complexities and contradictions and paradoxes, and in some ways see some of the, you know, what was good and kind and beautiful beneath what at first appeared, certainly in the role of the father figure, who's a pretty dislikable character, to be, you know, what first appeared to be ugly and unkind and cruel. So I guess that was sort of, in a way, looking at creating this movie maker figure allowed me to focus on my own role in writing and in some ways documenting this world.
Now, I want to go back to your own background, because as I understand it, if I'm not mistaken, your uncle is a literary critic, yes?
My great uncle, yeah.
Yeah, who wrote one of my favorite books in the world, The Banquet Years, and who was really my introduction not only to French literature, but to revolutionary, Dadaistic French literature, Jarry. And so it seems between the ACLU and your father and your uncle introducing America really for the first time to Apollinaire, Jarry, Satie, I mean, wonderful book, that you are dealing with a family that were rebellious.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's interesting. I think that definitely applies to my father in the 60s, as many people of his generation were. I think that was the generational gap between him and his parents was probably more extreme than it's been since then, possibly than it was before then. With the anti-war movement and the fathers who were veterans of World War II and the sons who were, you know, growing their hair long and protesting on the streets. So I don't know if he was totally exceptional in that way, but I think he was fairly rebellious, yeah. But the family has always been, I've always been a part of a pretty close family. So, there's rebelliousness, but it's never been like people aren't speaking to each other or there are these huge rifts or anything.
No, I meant that the people in this book are very self-consciously a land that time forgot. This is a group of people that never went through the rebellious period of American life. They have been isolated, if younger, by their prep schools, if older, by their families and traditions, by their houses. And so we have very much a world, as much as America has one, of a rigorous norm. But in the intervening years, the norm has become entirely eccentric, so that as we meet these people, what's frightening about them is they present what they think to be normal social behavior, but in fact is what?
Yeah, I think I see what you mean. There's that disconnect of their perceived place in society and the actual place that they hold. And to me, actually, that was one of the things that was really interesting and in a way gave me a certain affection for my characters, certainly by the end of the book, that there's this disconnect in their own perception of their place that's almost a little sad, you know. They're a little lost, and they, in some ways, are trying to figure out, well, what is their place in this new world of melting pot America, and where things are happening, and there's exciting things are afoot outside the green pastures of Concord, and they know that, and they want to feel a part of it, but they're sort of confined like their ancestors are in these sort of two-dimensional portraits of themselves.
Well, there's a hugely funny scene in which the great aunt Helen, whose name is Lilo, nickname is Lilo, they all have society monikers, yes?
Yeah, there's Skip and Bibi and Lilo.
Yeah, and they, she has not only been bemoaning the tragedy that her nephew, who she's raised as a son, has left his jacket in her old age home apartment, but she's found a condom in a pocket.
Right, right.
And she had no idea that her son was, what is the word she uses?
What does she call him? A gigolo, I think. And she doesn't know the word for a condom either, so she's calling the condom a phallatic.
And her way of dealing with this is to give it to the man's daughter and tell her to talk to her mother about this. And of course, she refuses to acknowledge that the mother is nowhere on the scene, the marriage having dissolved over 2 years before. And so this is someone who in every action is depending upon building a hypocritical, non-existent world.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of, it's that sort of fantasy if you act like things are a certain way, they will be that way. And if you continue to put a good face on it, and it's that general principle, I think, that the grandmother, or she's really the great aunt, employs probably the most extremely of anyone in the book. Although the father certainly has his own self delusions that do involve a kind of theatrical insistence on what isn't, but to such an extreme that it's almost persuasive. It almost works. I thought of the word. She calls him a common gigolo, and common is actually the common, I think, is the key word there.
It's very funny. By the way, I'm speaking to Jessica Shattuck. Her book is a new novel, The Hazards of Good Breeding, published by Norton. Ultimately, one at first looks at the title and thinks of a novel by William Dean Howells called A Hazard of New Fortunes. But it, in fact, refers to perhaps the dominant metaphor in the book. The father raises dogs. He's very proud of them, but they are really unfriendly dogs.
Yeah.
Even he has had to work them with collars that will administer shocks when they go outside the perimeter of their own property. And yet he loves them. They're versions of himself.
Yeah. Well, I think that the dogs are certainly in some ways stand-ins for him. And the dogs are products of good breeding, and Jack Dunlap is a product of good breeding. But something has gone awry. And in the end, the dogs can't survive. He loves these dogs, but he does have to kill one of them because it has kind of trespassed into, it can't take the world, the larger world that it has to live in, the same way he's having trouble taking the larger world he has to live in, although I think he's doing a little better than the dog. I think something that he loves about them is that the particular breed, the Australian cattle dog, is a very wild kind of breed, and it has dingo in it as well as border collie and shepherd. I'm forgetting what the last one is. There's four. It's a mix of four kinds of dogs. But he loves the. He thinks of it as the real animalness about them. He likes that they are really. I wrote that he really admires their firmness of intent and purpose, and I think there's something about that that parallels the kind of complicated ideal of the kind of puritanical old Yankee WASP character that Jack Dunlap is. And that ideal is this kind of very macho in a way, although macho isn't quite the word I'm looking for, but very strong, very manly, very masculine, very very intense and not very emotive, certainly not very affectionate kind of character. And he is that way, and his dogs are that way. And in the end, that particular way of being, that stoicism paired with an almost sort of violent independence, is proving pretty difficult in the modern world and in the world that he's living in the world of his family. He can't even express affection for his own children because he has no idea. He doesn't know the language of affection, let alone love.
Is the refusal of love one of the hazards of good breeding?
The refusal of love, or maybe I would say the isolation from love more than the refusal.
The disinclination to nurture.
Yeah, and I suppose something I was thinking about was when you are so imprisoned by the idea of kind of keeping your own feelings, keeping everything personal, locked away privately, and the public self being this creation of a very stoic and sort of unreadable creation, and when you are raised in such a way that your communication is perhaps stilted by such a belief in politeness and manners that you can't actually just come out and say whatever you want, that you do end up, a danger of that is that you end up on a little island that is yourself.
One of the funny things to put together about the book is that each of them yearns for, and until the end of the book, doesn't find the ability to have a friendly breakfast with pancakes and maple syrup. Jack at one point goes out and buys breakfast, but he hasn't told anyone he's going to, so they've all eaten by the time he arrives home with it. And of course, it's a takeout breakfast. Who gets a takeout breakfast? But by the end, someone has managed to find a way to be making blueberry pancakes, and there is a kind of ongoing feeling as a group of people who never thought they'd be together in the same room again are watching enough pancakes being made, silver dollar sized, to feed a whole new sense of family. What is the new sense of family by the end of the book?
I think the new sense of family is that the new sense of family includes the outsider, Rosita, and in a way there has been some realignment of this old, protected, brittle world that they live in to, you know, crumblingly, creakily accommodate a new piece, which is absolutely necessary, and they all realize it's necessary, and for each of them, that new piece, which is Rosita, means something else. And then in the end, it's not really a totally happy union, and in a way, the new sense of family unravels at the very end of the book. But I think of it as actually the new sense remains, but the actuality of it is broken apart. But just having come to that point of inclusion, I think means something.
Now I want to take a huge leap in my final question, and see. No. But it does seem to me that a version of this family is at the heart of many American novels, many classic American novels. And to some extent, what's happening is that these people are ripping the novel apart, bringing a new novel to birth. And in a sense, this is your baby. Will this baby be able to be accepted in the society that gave rise to it? What will the people in Massachusetts think of the hazards of good breeding?
I hope they'll like it. I mean, I think I've heard from people who I know who seem to be in the world that the story is set in, that they've really liked it. And I mean, I like to think that in a way it's a gentler novel, actually, than many novels about this world or set in this world, partly because of my own position in writing it. I've noticed that people who are really, truly from this world often either just completely embrace where they came from and replicate the lives of their parents and go to the same country clubs and drive the same car, or they really rebel against it. And if you're rebelling against it, I think you have to make a lot, you really distance yourself, and you possibly end up, if you were to write a book from that point of rebellion, it's likely to be an angrier book. And I think since I kind of saw this world as a part of what was appealing to me was just its kind of lostness in the world of today, I wasn't reacting to it from the point of view of someone who needs to, you know, this is a world of great power and influence, and I need to undermine that. So I really hope, I mean, I loved my characters. I miss them. I wish I was still writing the book in a way.
Well, and they haven't crushed you. They've crushed themselves.
Yeah. Although in the end, I hope that they're not totally crushed either. I think of them I think there's hope at the end.
I've been talking with Jessica Shattuck, author most recently of The Hazards of Good Breeding. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.